Good evening. You're either watching or listening to Redwood Wonk. I'm with David Frank. My name is Eric Kirk. We are discussing national politics of the day. And we have to start with the hurricanes that we've already had Elaine, the hurricane, run through. We've got Milton that's just now starting to run aground. It's set all kinds of records in terms of hot water and in the Gulf or in the ocean and a lot of other records breaking. It's a hurricane category 5. Trump said that he has never heard of a hurricane category 5 hitting land, which is really strange because he said the exact same thing about a hurricane way back when he was in office. But at any rate, there have been all kinds of political issues that have been raised because the Trump campaign and a number of Republicans outside of the hit areas, and I want to emphasize that, outside of those areas, have went right on the attack, accusing the Biden administration and FEMA of inadequate response, and even some more incendiary accusations that they're stealing land, that they're trying to bulldoze over a particular town so they can mine for lithium to support their EV agenda, the hurricanes have been geoengineered to specifically hit Trump majority districts. And Marjorie Taylor Greene kind of doubled down on that. And so, it has led, but Republicans in the area have actually been contradicting Trump, Vance, and some of them. I mean, the governors, they are not playing politics with the exception of DeSantis, but we'll get to that. But even he talks about how he's been in conversation with Joe Biden on a regular basis. The other governors and the senators, Tom Tillman, are all saying that FEMA is doing what it can on the ground. It was ready and it's been doing what it needs to be doing. And of course, you know, there's always other things that need to be done that aren't getting done, but that's just a bit matter of capacity. Congressional representative, House Representative Chuck Edwards of North Carolina had to issue a statement. It's an 8-point statement, and I'll go into it in a little more detail in a little bit. But the first thing he has to tell his Republican constituents is that Hurricane Helena was not geoengineered by the government to seize access lithium deposits in Chimney Rock. That's number one. There's a bunch of other things that he's clearing up, but he also says real clear FEMA is not going to run out of money. The claim that, oh, they're sending it to help immigrants and foreign aid, those are all separate packages, separate funding. And so it can't be drawn from one to the other. The FAA is not restricting access to airspace. Trump keeps saying that. There's no helicopters. There's nothing happening on the ground. Trying to basically manufacture a controversy where there really is none, at least not according to leaders in the area, both Democratic and Republican. And this is really a shame because it's actually, because some people are believing a lot of this stuff, it's actually hampering FEMA efforts. People don't want to leave the area because they're afraid it's going to be seized and lithium grabbed from their house, whatever. I mean, it's just, it interferes with it. It causes confusion. I mean, there was a time when there was an ethos, even in the middle of a campaign, that you support the country's leadership in an emergency, at least for the first few days. You can be critical later. Come in later and complain about what was done. But for the first few days, you are a united nation in the face of catastrophe. And this is not happening. This is not the politics of normal anymore. And it's really a shame, and it's dangerous, and maybe even lethal. I can go into more details, but Dave, I'm going to let you chime in here.
Yeah, thank you very much for that setup. I think that you kind of framed the issue accurately. The big picture, I think, actually, President Biden framed pretty well that we're in the midst of two historic hurricane storms in 2 weeks. There's been an emergency declaration. There's been a surge of resources. There's been federal and state coordination. But unfortunately, these are Biden's words, there's been a reckless promotion of misinformation and lies that are harmful to people who need the help most. So I think that's a great way to start this conversation out, on my end.
Are lies. These are bald-faced lies. Yeah. Like Trump and Vance know this is not true, what he's saying. And that's really criminal.
Yeah, I mean, I think honestly, I try never to use the term lie. I'm always trying to give people the benefit of the doubt that there's some manipulation or some hedging of phraseology. But it's getting a little bit, the slope is very slippery here. And at some point, you almost, if the shoe fits, right, you have to use the term misinformation is by another, phrase is a lie. If you're intentionally stoking fear based on something that has zero basis in fact. So I'm going to go straight to North Carolina State Senator, Republican, Kevin Corbin, who recently spoke out against false allegations. And he said, look, there's a list of misinformation here that I want to just wants to flag. And so he said, like you said, most of these, I think, that FEMA is stealing money from donations, that body bags have been ordered, but the government has denied them, that, bodies are not being buried, that the government created and directed the damaging weather, that the government is lying to confiscate lithium reserves, that, stacks of bodies are left at hospitals. It's a tragedy. It's an unprecedented tragedy in this region, too. But yet the headlines across multiple states in the region read that they're highlighting the lies, in effect. And so even FEMA itself had to create a rumor response website. So we are actually talking about like the harm being caused by misinformation. What is so harmful about lies and fabrications of this nature? Why spread misinformation and conspiracy theories? Unfortunately, it's relatively simple, that it's to exploit fear and mistrust for political gain. It's like basically just, it is what it appears to be on the surface. It's disaster exploitation. So really, we have, candidate Trump, former President Trump, and the chair, Lara Trump, chair of the GOP, who's a North Carolina resident. They are, harmonizing messaging and going out to public speaking events in Trump's case, or making media appearances in Lara Trump's case. And they are talking about redirected money that's not true at all, like you said, to migrants, that there are different pools of money, among other things, right? So just big picture, you even have Laura Loomer, who was advocate of President Trump during the campaign. They were seen together a few weeks ago. That story has kind of fallen off the radar, but she came out and said, people of Appalachia, do not comply with FEMA. It's a matter of life and death. So, the bottom line is that these people, if you are in a natural disaster, the people that show up to help you, if you are fundamentally mistrustful of the situation, it goes against your best interest. But and I'll just say this, and then I'll hand it back to you. Many GOP leaders, not just in North Carolina, which we're talking about right now, but across multiple affected states, have been contradicting this, these claims, and they're yes. Basically. And so you mentioned, I think, Senator Tom Tillis, a Republican. He said, look, this is unprecedented. No one was prepared for a massive hurricane to hit in the middle of North Carolina, and that, all right. Aid is being deployed successfully. North Carolina governor, the federal response has been unprecedented. Florida Governor DeSantis, the federal government has provided everything we've asked. And then other messaging has gone out from various sources, saying it's the largest crisis event on record in this region. States are working nonstop. FEMA is here. The power companies have tens of thousands of workers on the ground. The National Guard's deployed. The Federal Department of Transportation's deployed. It's an all hands on deck situation. So it's really a tale of two cities. There's what's actually happening in the face of tragedy, and then there's basically what amounts to an unfortunate exploitative communication strategy.
Yeah, and what needs to be understood is the National Guard was deployed before the hurricane hit. They were out there. They're on the ground and ready to go, doing what they can. There's only so much you can do, you know, with all of it, with biblical flooding and stuff like that. I mean, but they're doing what they can. They are out there on the ground doing it. There's a bit of a problem. Well, like with what Laura Loomer is saying, don't comply with FEMA. She's going to get Trump's constituents killed. This is reminiscent of the of COVID, when, you know, Trump was giving bad information and bad advice that got a lot of his own constituents killed. There are some people who argue that that's why the Republicans didn't retake the Senate in 2022. I think that's a bit exaggerated, but it probably was a factor, because there's also conspiracy theories about that. Gosh, but why is the disease killing more Republicans? Well, because, you know, they're being encouraged to be idiots. And that's the same thing in this case. They're not taking advice to leave the towns that they're in, even now with Milton coming in, because they just don't trust the government. Well, that's deadly, and that's what really needs to be emphasized. And once this Hurricane Milton is passed, if we're kind of out of the crisis, Harris really needs to make this a campaign issue. Right now, the media is just kind of going, well, it's Trump being Trump. No, it's not Trump being Trump. It's deadly. He's going to get people killed. And that needs to be really understood. And there's so much to go into in the politicization of this. Of course, in the middle of this, Harris herself has been talking with people and doing some coordination. But Governor DeSantis of Florida, who we'll be talking about in another segment, in more detail, refused to take her calls. And then he made a comment about how that's just selfish and petty. And then he says, yeah, she hasn't done anything in hurricanes. There's no reason for me to talk to her. She's just looking for an opportunity to benefit her campaign. And it's just like, and they went to the Harris campaign for a response to that. And so far they said, nah, we're not going to bother. It's sad. And it's pathetic what is happening here. But I'm glad that there are some Republicans that are willing to step up, and respond. Are they going to withdraw their endorsements of Trump? I don't know. I don't know how many of them actually did. I don't know about Chuck Edwards, for instance. But he emphasized, he's got an 8-point in a statement that he put on his website. Hurricane Helene was not geoengineered. Local officials are not abandoning search and rescue efforts to bulldoze over Chimney Rock, supposedly where there's lithium. FEMA is not stopping trucks or vehicles with donations or confiscating supplies or turning away donations. FEMA has not diverted disaster response to funding to border or foreign aid. He explains each one. FEMA is not going to run out of money. FEMA cannot seize your property or land. The FAA is not restricting air rescue. And FEMA is not just providing $750 to disaster survivors. That's just a beginning. So he had to make those 8 points clear. He explains each one. And the fact that he has to do this to try to make it so that people can understand. Now, the communities that were hit are disproportionately Trump supporting communities, or were, it's unfortunate, because this could impact the election in Georgia and even more so in North Carolina. And it's interesting that Democrats are calling for relaxing some of the requirements, such as ID, photo ID, and the rest of Republicans are still not doing it. I don't think they've done the math yet. There's so much to say about it. And we can only discuss too much, but this is not what should be happening in American politics. Absolutely the opposite. And it is just sad that we've degraded to this.
So one of the things that I know we just have a couple of minutes left. One of the things that I think stands out, and I wish it wasn't the case, but from time to time we talk about how the whole, you know, the strategy of team building, the strategy of a political, in this case, the Republican team, that they'll think to themselves that the benefit that they get from a communication is more important than the reality of the situation or the consequences of those potentially fabricated communications. So what am I talking about? Well, with the fear mongering about the body bags and the death counts and the more, you know, dead people piling up and this sort of thing, we're talking about a relatively low number, about 250-ish so far confirmed dead, the last that I looked, which is awful. Nobody wants any to lose a family member, you know, in a flood. But the reality of it is that there were, I think the last number I saw was nearly 9,000 people saved. You know,
yes,
over 1,000 National Guards folks out there, probably tens or, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, good Samaritans, you know, local responders, like literally saving thousands and thousands of people, people coming together. And so this is divisive when it didn't need to be, but just in terms of team building, you've seen, I don't know, maybe you haven't seen them, but there's these AI generated photos out there of Trump, like in the water, like rescuing people. And other, you know, really branded messaging. And it seems like the political theater has become a place where the consequences matter less, because there doesn't seem to be much accountability. So hopefully in the coming month, coming weeks, people really can focus a little bit more on the healing and aspiration and recovery instead of this divisiveness in the face of tragedy.
I think one of the things I've been concerned about this week is that we're all sitting, as you refer to, the bubble. We've been sitting in our bubble, having a good laugh at this total, as you said, show. But the truth is that this plays to a lot of people that he has to win to become the next president. And I have to say, I mean, I'm sorry to have to kind of be the buzzkill here so early on, but I think Trump is going to win. I'm sorry.
You know what? Boo if you want. I am glad you're saying it. Everybody should say that. No, no. The enemy is complacency. Yeah.
I live in Michigan. Let me tell you. I was there during the Michigan primary, and he went there in front of the Ford, and he said, I'm telling you right now, they moved this factory to Mexico. I'm putting the tariff on the cars, and that's it. And it was music to people's ears.
So in 2016, in front of an astounded audience, Michael Moore predicted, I believe it was in late August before the election, that Trump was going to win. Over the months before that, he'd been begging the Clinton campaign to dedicate some time in the what was then referred to as the Blue Wall. We also call it the Rust Belt. These are the key three key battleground states, as we say it, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. She did not even really appear there within the last few weeks. Part of the problem is that she and her husband represent a kind of a neoliberalism that led to the trade agreements, which cost a lot of jobs in those areas. So in some ways, Trump was actually running to her left on some economic issues that resonated. He was in the community. He's a resident of Michigan. He's talking with people, and he was saying, forget about the polls. I just don't see how she's going to win this. And I think it's too late as of late August. Well, she won the popular vote, but lost in all three of those states. Then in 2022, everybody was talking about the red wave. Everybody was talking about how the Republicans were expected to land 53 or 54 senators. And even you and I were actually, I believe you and I were somewhat confident that the Democrats would hold But we did look at those concerns as to what could happen and took them seriously. He did not. He says, I'm here on the ground. What I am seeing is that he is not going to win in Pennsylvania. The Republicans are not going to win in Pennsylvania. He was not at all surprised that Fetterman pulled it out. Everybody is in for a shock because there is not going to be a red wave. He was right. Caveat. He was wrong in 2012 when he was being depressing and saying that Romney was going to win. But that was partly based on a really bad debate performance by Obama and a couple other things. So things turned around in that one. But the point is he's saying ignore the polls. The women are going to turn out and the young women are going to turn out in record numbers. And they are going to win this for Harris. You and I have talked about the Dobbs effect that gets very little mention in the news. Although I did hear some pundits finally talking about how a lot of record number of young women, young people, and especially young women registering, they might confound the likely voter formulas, and that it's possible, as we've discussed on the show, we don't know who might be ahead. It might be the Trump effect again, or it might be the Dobbs effect, or maybe it's a wash. But she's been consistently 2 or 3 points ahead in the polls, and this is the problem. If she's 2 points ahead, she's most likely going to lose. If she's 3 points ahead, she's most likely going to win. So that's a big deal of the difference between those. She came out with the Siena poll, though, showed a 4-point increase since September. In September, the Siena New York Times poll, which is one of the highest rated polls and has been trending conservative over the past couple of seasons, in terms of its not in terms of its politics, but in terms of its predictions, has her now up ahead 3 points. That's a 4-point movement. So we'll see. But again, Michael Moore is telling us, don't look at the polls. They don't mean anything. Look at voter registration and feel the pulse on the ground in the states that matter. Dave?
Yeah, so I actually went back and looked at some of what Michael Moore had said, just because I was curious where it came from. And it turns out there was a Substack article that was written, and then it got a lot of traction. The short version, and then media went and interviewed him and asked him, hey, what did you have in mind when you wrote this? So I think there's two lanes here for understanding or getting a better understanding of where he was coming from. He was trying to make, I think, in a little bit of a sense, he was trying to make light of it by saying Democrats are very fearful of Trump winning, but you don't need to be. So the first part of this is that he's saying that, you know, from the folks he's spoken with, that there are like insider polls that are commissioned polls that are non-public polls that elites, and these are his quotes, elites, Wall Street, and members of Congress have seen, and they know the fate of Trump's. This is a quote, that the fate of Trump's run for office has already been sealed. So why does he think this? What did he see? It's called them private and internal polling. Basically, because he's talking about and he used the term the tsunami of women. I think you might have said this already, but the tsunami of women that are going to show up on election day. He says you got to keep in mind that women across America were told they no longer have the right to reproductive freedom. And they know that Trump is the one who took this away from them. It's a recognition of, like you said, the Dobbs effect, the response to Trump's appointed Supreme Court justices overturning Roe. He's really hanging his hat heavily on that. When he speaks to the polls themselves, he says, look, don't discount or ignore them, but just remember that they're not determinative. And he points to, like you said, you know, back in 2016, and he says, hey, New York Times model said Hillary has an 85% chance of winning to Trump's 15%. And you and I, we tend to look back then, we looked at the 538 model, which was closer to, I think, 70 to 30%. But the point is that there's more to the process than just polling numbers and modeling numbers. And what Michael Moore said is that he puts his faith in surveys that actually question voters on the issues rather than candidates. So I'll pivot to this briefly and then get some feedback from you that, you know, he's talking about. He says, look, the vice president's progressive policy positions on abortion, the environment, guns, jobs are in the mainstream. And yeah, there's a reason she's so progressive on the face of it. It's because things like a woman's right to choose. And then he says, go down all her positions. And then he kind of rattles them off. And that's again, his words. The majority of Americans believe climate change is real, that the minimum wage is too low, that America needs regulations, that we don't want to live in a country where a hurricane hits and only 1% of the people have flood insurance because it's unaffordable. He's saying that, you know, this is what's at stake. And the people already have opinions on the policies, and the policies already align so favorably with Harris and her positions. And there's another piece to this, but I'll get you some feedback on the policy side.
Well, he does discuss the tangibles, but in his interviews, he also talks about the intangibles, the feeling he has when he's out there. He's somebody who does actually get out and talk to people, partly as because he writes about it, but also because that's just what he does. That's what makes him good at his filmmaking when he's doing that. I mean, it's just I'm not going to say that his feelings are like an Old Testament prophet or anything like that, but I take them very seriously. And he's somebody who is more prone to what people have interpreted as cynicism. When he said that in 2016 in front of an audience that Clinton was going to lose, he was booed, or at least groaned. You know, people were like, no, that can't be true. But he gets a feeling on the ground. It's not something you can really, depend on. It's not science. It's different. But his feeling I take more seriously than a lot of the objective models. And, let's be fair to Nate Silver. When he said 70-30%, as he pointed out afterwards, that means that there's a 30% chance that Trump would win. That's, that is real. If I meant 100%, I would have said that, right? It doesn't mean he's going to win. And so I think the models are still kind of useful, but I pay less attention to them than I do to the polls themselves. I'm going to explain in my prediction that I think Cook Political Report is like way overboard on one of their models for one of the state Senate races. I'll talk about it at the end of the show, but I'll explain why. This is something we need to take seriously. Bill Maher also predicted that Clinton was going to win. Lose. And he's almost absolutely certain that Harris is going to win this one. I mean, and again, these are intangibles, but these are guys who are cynical, who don't like to have good news. They like to be funny with their bad news, right? And they both seem positive. Howard Stern is positive, upbeat about it, right? I mean, it's just she was on the Howard Stern. She went on a media blitz. And of course, a lot of the DC lawyers don't like the fact that she's talking to entertainment people and the rest, but she's actually reaching the people. The people who watch those shows have already made up their mind one way or another, right? The ones that they want her to be on. But we didn't set that up as a topic this time around. But I mean, and there's still almost a month left, so a lot can happen in that time. And feelings could change about it, but I take Michael Moore seriously when he says something like that, especially how so kind of sure he is about it.
Yeah, I would say, just to piggyback on what you said about feelings and the visceral, I got a couple observations here. One is just simply from Michael Moore's own words. He really was framing this as advice to Harris, saying, look, don't run away from the policies that are connecting. to young people, to women, to not just Democrats and not just independents, but to actually Republican young people and Republican women. Like this, this is why you have the advantage. You know, like any said, don't follow the advice of the experts that are surrounding you that are telling you to pivot to the center now in the closing weeks of the election. Stick to what got you here. Stick to what gave you this you know, this advantage. Yes, you can have your surrogates go out to the business channel like CNBC, who are talking about how pro-business you are and how you're going to do whatever the wealthy donors need you to do and that sort of thing. But don't you engage in this yourself. Like, don't drop talking about the policies that are popular. You might end up reducing or depressing the vote, and you need your base energized. You need them to come out. So there was a degree of advice, not a small degree either, of advice involved in his, you know, motivation for this. But I do want to go back to the visceral, because he also wrote about the intangibles. And his feelings, like what's triggering his spidey sense about Trump's weakness? And he says one thing, you know, Trump just didn't acknowledge that sleepy Joe Biden was no longer the opponent. He was slow to respond, and when he did, he was dismissive of his opposition. And he then proceeded to be undisciplined, ranting about, you know, kind of ridiculous topics like Hannibal Lecter, Haitians cannibalizing pets. And just nonstop from him and Vance both, honestly. This is Michael Moore, nonstop misogyny, racism. And Trump said that if he loses, you know, it might be the Jews' fault, for example. Like, right. These are things that should be taboo. And it's certainly, you know, if you're trying to build consensus amongst America writ large, that's, you're just alienating people left and right. That's not a strategy. That's more like Tourette's syndrome or something like that. That's what Michael Moore's theme was. And also he's saying that Trump weaponized the border issue. And then, like in the debate, for example, many of the questions that would be on a different topic, Trump would bring up the border, like when he was asked in a different conference about childcare, what's your plan for childcare? And he went to tariffs. Like, he's just an undisciplined person. And so Michael Moore says, in fact, he's emerged now as pretty much the laughingstock of thoughtful people. And most of what he says is debunked and dismissed. Yeah. And that, you know, that the truth is that's why he's so confident, like that the emperor in this case has no clothes, basically. Those aren't his words, but he's like, you know, Trump seems like an insurmountable and massively diabolically difficult challenger in a near heads up debate, you know, competition rather. But from his position, it's, you know, it's probably over already, because Trump just can't do anything but appear absurd.
I mean, he didn't say it explicitly, but others have said it may be that for certain people, including a lot of Republicans, his gig is getting old. Yep. You know, 2016, it was new. The media is still making the same mistakes of 2016. He gets all the coverage. I mean, it's hard for Harris to even break in to get a headline. He gets all the headlines. He writes something stupid on Truth Social, and it's all over, you know, the place. I mean, it's just that is the way it is. The stuff, but he's being contradicted now by Republicans, not just on this area, but the Charlotte Observer slammed him for what he's doing with regard to it. I mean, slammed him hard. And a lot of Republicans are going to read that article. It really actually, do people say, well, didn't it feel like that Clinton was going to win? No, it actually didn't. There was like an underlying dread. It objectively seemed like she was going to win by the objective evidence. But I had a real bad feeling the night before when I watched the comparative events. Her being a glitzy kind of Hollywood thing with stars, and his being in Detroit, which was a total raw meat thing. I mean, anyway, we'll find out. But Michael Moore, I find that interesting.
We're just here to do our business the way we've been asked to do it.
And it was done to prevent us from doing our job. And that is offensive to me. There's a lot of little back and forth going on now with the state taking control, but rest assured, you know, you ain't seen nothing yet. There's more to come in that regard.
A company has a right to freedom of speech just like individuals do. In effect, to seek to punish a company for its exercise of a constitutional right. And that just seems really wrong to me.
So we're going to go back down to Florida, where the Hurricane Milton is just coming ashore now, just hitting people. And so they probably aren't going to be thinking a lot about politics or even the issues we're discussing, but they are very serious. And if they're a harbinger of what's to come, if there is a complete change of American politics, we need to be very concerned. Of course, we've been reporting and discussing the book burnings and banning, right? well, it's a euphemism, but the use of heavy-handed approach to immigrants who might have accidentally voted, you know, against the law. Actually the FEMA funds that were used to ship immigrants up to Martha's Vineyard. I mean, that was way out of line, apparently, or I don't know if it was FEMA, but emergency funds. A lot of politics there, but it's gotten even more bizarre at this point. Florida, of course, has a referendum initiative that would strengthen the rights of its citizens in terms of the right to have an abortion. It has to actually win 60% of the vote in order to pass. It's something that that got onto the ballot. They didn't want it on the ballot. And he wanted to, he says it's not intimidation, but he actually used the election police to actually go and interview people who signed that petition. And this freaked them out. They're being questioned. And it's like, well, no, charges aren't being made. You know, they're just being asked questions. You shouldn't have police showing up at your door to talk about a petition you signed. That is just absolute, banana republic kind of stuff. This is the type of thing that happens under authoritarian regimes where they're trying to intimidate their opposition. And then there's a commercial referendum people want to air, and it's pretty powerful. And he is threatening jail to any television station that airs it. I mean, this is really scary. It's getting passed around. Currently Florida has a 6-week abortion ban, and the ad claims that the law endangers women who have a pressing medical need for an abortion and can't get one in the state. And the official government position is that the law has exceptions, but we know that these exceptions haven't done well for women in other states. Where, you know, one woman died, as was pointed out by Walls in the last debate. But at any rate, he is threatening. He does not want that aired, and so basically, setting aside the First Amendment. By making these threats. And of course, you know, we hear all about how the Biden administration or the government or the FBI was intimidating Facebook by, you know, talking about that certain stories might be a part of a Russian propaganda campaign. But this is outright intimidation. This is straight up, you're threatening to jail people for speaking for an expression that you don't like, that it goes contrary to your political positions. This is dangerous stuff. We can get into more details about exactly what he's doing, but I'd like to turn it over to you.
Well, great. Thank you very much for that setup. As I mentioned to you candidly, this is just an issue that I think is like absurd. It's almost impossible to wrap your head around that this is even happening. Why do I say that? There's firsthand evidence that, you know, that there's a million people signed this petition, plus an extra 100,000 people to get it on the ballot. So it has strong support. And it, even though 60% threshold to pass it to viability, to change it from a 6-week abortion ban to viability, really the big part of the improvement here isn't just access to abortion. It's a safe space, you know, reproductive freedom, the conversations between patients and doctors to, because now the bureaucracy is defending itself. The hospital bureaucracy is fearful of consequence. Doctors could go to jail and hospitals can be face serious reprimand. So this isn't just abortion access itself. Not that that's a small thing, but it's really the whole entire system of state intimidation of reproductive freedom. So with this in mind, Governor DeSantis has empowered one of his agencies to go door to door, police power, people with police power, with folders of information on the person. And so they say they ask for the person by name who signed the petition, and they show them the portfolio of documentation they have about them, a copy of their identification. And it's truly what they're saying is they are investigating fraud. They're saying, we believe you've been a participant in a fraud scheme. You may be the victim of the fraud scheme. Did you sign this? And suddenly it's like, what is going on here? So there are citizens that have come said that these plainclothes officers are intimidating and invoking fear. And so the criticism is like, and we're talking about only half of, you know, one issue here, but is it an abuse of power? Is it corruption? The initiative, the amendment is already on the ballot. So if they were actually disputing the signatures, there's a different mechanism for that. They could, you know, when you question something getting on a ballot, you go through and you ask the people whose signatures you disagree with. You say, hey, that signature looks like it's a disqualifying signature. And maybe you would investigate a disqualifying signature. They're not doing that. They're going in and they're investigating people who are actually perceived as legitimate. So it just shows that there's a bias in the approach, an entire, that in theory, by going outside of the normal process to prevent fraud, it's indicative that the real purpose is intimidation, and in particular, potentially minority communities where there's already some skepticism about authority figures in general, you know, because of immigration status, et cetera. And I would say, like, from this perspective on this policy, voter intimidation is voter suppression. I would say this is nothing less than a voter suppression effort, which is really unfortunate. If you'd like, I mean, I would like to also pivot to the other issue about the advertisement. But is there anything you want to mention more about the door-to-door policing?
No, I think you've about said it, and I'll clarify exactly what he's threatening, and then I'll ask you to step in. But basically, there is a law, like there is in everyone, it's against the law to create a public health nuisance. So his theory is that by making women afraid to go get help, and maybe we'll go to another state for help or something like that, by creating fear, by saying these things that are, by the way, true, that you are creating a public nuisance because women might die because you've made them afraid, not because of the law. And he's very specific with threatening media people 60 days in jail for it. Very specific. That's even more chilling when he's talking about it. And, you know, the First Amendment ought to protect it. But what it does is it forces now the people who are running these television stations to have to risk the possibility that they're going to jail while this is all pending in court to get the charges dropped. Most likely they will, but you know, the Florida courts, it's hard to know what they'll do or what the federal courts will do. So is it being effective? I don't know. I've been trying to find out if it's been aired or not. It's all over social media. People are spreading it like crazy. But I'll let you chime in on that.
Yeah. So these Floridian, the organization that produced the ad and that's paying for it to be aired in local television, NBC stations, affiliates across Florida, they're called Floridians Protecting Freedom, and they're making the case of a real person that had a real health crisis that was potentially life-threatening based on the existing law, where doctors were afraid, the hospital was afraid, and they ended up going, driving 4 hours out of state to get treatment, life-saving treatment. And the thing is, it's really, it's subjective when a treatment is considered life-saving. So the risk to the doctor, to the hospital, to the patient, that's, we've covered this in other topics. But what we're talking about now is the actual the advertising ban itself. And so the Florida Department of Health is saying, look, this is criminal of you to air this, because they're making the claim against an affiliate in Gainesville and an affiliate in Tampa. They're sending cease and desist orders, and they're saying that you what you are about to air, you know, is a categorically false, and that, you know, current law does not, you know, allow doctors it does not prevent doctors from performing necessary to preserve the life and health of a woman, and that it's dangerous what you're doing. If you air this ad, it's dangerous, and that's why we're going to criminally prosecute you for airing it. Turns out that the federal FCC chair, Jessica Rosenworcel, she actually came out and said, look, the right of broadcast, this is a quote, the right of broadcasters to speak freely is rooted in the First Amendment. Threats against broadcast stations for airing content that conflicts with the government's views are dangerous and undermine the fundamental principles of free speech. And so there's this legal, it's pretty obvious that in court, every case pretty much across federal courts have always defended political speech. And that the Florida Department of Health's claim that it violates the state's ban on a, quote, nuisance injurious to health. So, for example, there was a, I think it was a Slate article that says, yes, this is the same law that targets leaky septic tanks and being exposed to consequences from slaughterhouses. Somehow it's being applied to political speech. So it's a almost Orwellian use of public health to use this law to block the airing of a campaign. And more broadly, like you're the lawyer here, you're the expert on this stuff. But to be honest, like there's tons of like case law out there where it's saying that the communicative content, any blocking of communicative content, easy for me to say, about for when it's political speech, is presumed to be unconstitutional. That's the whole strict scrutiny requirement. Campaign speech is defended and protected by extraordinary strict scrutiny. So the supporters of the ballot initiative, the candidates, and then the media that publishes that speech have sweeping First Amendment rights. We know that the governor and his people either know that what they're doing is patently unconstitutional, or they don't care.
Yeah, I mean, it was aired on the article that I found, it an NBC affiliate. They're not being specific about the station.
I have the stations. I have the two of them. Oh, the one that aired it. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, the one that actually aired it. And they're not threatening, you know, not just the management, but employees who were involved in it. I mean, this is just outright, it's incredible that this is even happening. I mean, it should not even be a case. You need to have a compelling state interest to actually shut down speech that is based on what I believe this is called Amendment 4. Is what they're trying to pass. So it's, you're in the middle of a campaign, and you've got, you know, one side has prepared an ad that to express its point of view, and you are trying to suppress it. I mean, you need to overcome immense barriers before you could actually do that in court. There used to be what's referred to as the clear and present danger test, that it would actually have to be threatening and some harm would have to be imminent. When you were talking about incitement, people, they tried to charge people in the 60s with incitement because Dan Siegel in Berkeley said someone ought to burn down the ROTC building. Later that night, it got burned down. Well, it was hyperbole. He didn't actually mean for it to happen. He didn't set time, and the courts basically said he would have to set time, place, and manner. He'd actually have to be directing people to do it, not just yelling someone ought to do it. That's not enough. And so he would have an immense threshold. But when you're threatening to jail not just the management, but even the employees who are involved, I mean, who's going to want to do it? You know, who's going to want to take that kind of a chance? Well, maybe some are, and I haven't been able to find any coverage. At least one station did play it. I don't know if they're continuing to play it. But when you try to censor something like that, what happens is it goes viral and people will see it. So I think it was not only bad law and unethical, but I think it was also bad strategy. Is Amendment 4 going to pass? I don't know. I think the polls are showing that not that it won't win the majority, but getting 60%, that's a big threshold. But we'll see.
I know we're just in the closing minutes here, and I think it's, you know, from my perspective, I just want to like double down on the fact that how ridiculous of an attempt it is. We know why they're doing it, because like you said, they're going to, you know, the yes campaign to reinstate abortion rights are conceivably pretty close to that 60% threshold. They're already near 50, and there's a pretty large undecided population. And so that it's the writing's on the wall that this very well could pass. So the state is using funds to air ads against it, and trying to shut down any popular spreading of the messaging, which we've talked about so far. But I want to just hammer this one point home, that the First Amendment protects citizens' rights to promote known falsehoods outside of a few narrow exceptions like defamation. Yep. And so even the, you know, the former FCC chair, Tom Wheeler, said bluntly, you're allowed to lie. Like, yeah. Political ads are allowed to be lies. It's in the case law. And so that, like, there's almost no ground to stand on to try to prevent this from airing.
Eeny, meeny, chilly, beeny, the spirits are about to speak.
Are they friendly spirits?
Friendly? Just listen.
This brings us to our predictions. Dave, what do you have for us?
So this week, I'm going to refer to the most recent segment we just did on Amendment 4 in Florida, which is the reinstatement of abortion rights up to the point of fetal viability, which would overturn the 6-week ban that's currently in place. In the language of the bill, I think there's an element that says generally acknowledged to be the 24th week of presidency. The 24th week of pregnancy. So when you look at the polling right now, it's yes 46, no 38, with 16 undecided. And that's according to one recent poll. So it's really close to meet this 60% threshold. You would need almost all of the undecideds to come over into the yes side, perhaps get a few of the current no's to come over. So it's really close. It's razor thin. But my prediction is that just based on the heavy-handedness of Governor DeSantis's approach, going door to door and confronting and intimidating voters and blocking advertising like patent, like boldface violation, constitutional violations of political messaging and advertising, that there will be a reaction. There will be people thinking this is too heavy-handed by half. And my prediction is that Amendment 4 will pass in Florida.
I wonder if it'll have an impact on the Senate and presidential races down there. We'll see. All right, I'm going to make a prediction here. I am going to contradict Cook political report. Had to resist saying Cook's Country. I get them mixed up all the time, the kitchen thing show. But they have moved the Wisconsin, Tammy Baldwin versus Hovde, if I'm saying that name right, the Republican, from their lean Democrat to their toss-up. This is based upon their poll had gives Baldwin a 2% lead, and a couple of other polls also showed a shift from September down to a closer race. On the other hand, since they've done this switch, Quinnipiac, which actually also trends conservative of late, has Baldwin ahead by 4 points. And you look down the polls, and there's not one poll that has the Republican ahead. And every single poll has Baldwin ahead. The lowest is 2 points. The largest is 7 or 8 points. And this is going back quite a while. I think Cooks is trying to get some attention here, and to their own poll. I think they're putting too much stock in their own poll. I am predicting that Baldwin is going to win this race, and probably by 5 points or more. I do not think that there is a horse race here that, at least not as being reported by some of the media, not all of the media. We'll find out if we're right in our predictions, but until next time, stay informed and stay engaged.